and we can get started.
Put this in the middle. So I know that they have just introduced themselves, but allow me to introduce them to you again. So we're going to move along to the formal part of this afternoon's proceedings, and we have three people who are going to give us some general feedback and advice on how to write ARC applications. We're going to start with Joanne Tompkins, who is also a member of the College of Experts in the ARC. So she's very well placed to give us some information about that. Joanne is incredibly busy. She's also the head of the of EMSA here on campus. So after she has spoken to us, maybe if we have a few questions directly about what Joanne talks to us about, we can have those questions next, and then Joanne will need to get on with her day. And then after that, we will hear from Gay Hawkins, who's the director of the Centre for Critical and Cultural Studies at UQ, and Tom O'Regan, who is a professor of Media and Cultural Studies in EMSA here at UQ as well. And then we will have, after they've finished talking, we'll have open question time, and we can all ask very directed questions about our particular applications and whatever questions we might have. So I will turn over to Joanne now, who has helpfully provided us with some handouts as well.
I'll come to those as I go through. Okay, I'm going to give you a lot of information. It's common sense information, but it's common sense information that we all need to be reminded of when we're applying for ARCs. And I think maybe one of the first things I'd say is if you're offered an opportunity like this or one offered by UQ generally or Griffith or QUT or whomever, take it up. I participated with Gay in the large ARC session last week, and I learned stuff, the one that UQ offered. I learned a few things that I will be applying in the application that I'm putting in this year, and I read a lot of grants. So it's not like I don't know. It was just the way somebody said something. It made me think, oh, that can help me frame my information a little bit better. Okay. So I'm going to go through a whole bunch of things, starting with how to begin, ending with some do's and some don'ts. So when you begin, when you've got an idea, you think you might be able to be writing an ARC application about whether it's a DECRA or a discovery, workshop it a little first. Check with others about whether or not it's actually appropriate, an appropriate scale for an ARC grant. I kind of liken it at this stage to when you first come up with a PhD topic, or if you're a lecturer, when a PhD student potential comes to you. Often the topic is far too big in scope, or not quite proportionate, or just not quite fitting into an appropriate size. So talk to a few other people and get a second opinion on whether or not you're conceiving it in the right way. Look at previous grants. Elizabeth's helpfully got a few successful grants around. It's really important to see how other people have done it, the way that that they've framed it. Talk to a lot of people, especially people who are experienced in getting grants. Line them up to help you, to read your draft, bother them, keep pestering them, nag them, become their worst nightmare. And just keep getting feedback from them on successive iterations. Bother anybody who will listen. If your school, center, faculty has a readership program, take part in it. It's really important to get feedback. And at this stage, there is no such thing as feedback that is wrong. It's so easy when you get someone who's from another it's important to get someone from your own discipline and important to get people from outside your discipline. It's so easy, and I know from experience, when you get someone from outside your discipline to say, well, they didn't really understand it, and that's because they're from another discipline. But if they didn't understand it, chances are other people won't understand it, and not everybody who reads your grant will be from your discipline. So it's really important to pay attention to what anyone says and start early. The next section is paying attention to how your grant will actually be assessed. Because if you have a bit of an understanding of how it's going to be assessed, you'll have a slightly better understanding about how to write your application. So there's three different types of people who will read your application once it's submitted. There's the specialist and the discipline specialist and the generalist, the ARC College of Expert Readers. I'm the generalist kind of reader. So the specialist and the discipline specialist used to be called Australian or Aus readers and INT or international readers, but they've been dropping that that term. So a specialist is someone who overlaps with the FOR codes, but maybe not directly or completely. And the discipline specialist is going to be someone who has much more of an understanding of what you're writing about. The person from the College of Experts may not even be from your discipline. And that's not necessarily a disadvantage. I know some people think, oh, well, there isn't anyone on the panel who's from my discipline, whatever my discipline is. Therefore, I will never get a grant. That's not true. It's not true at all. But knowing that all of these different types of people are going to be reading your application should help you not use too much inside disciplinary specific jargon. It should help you make it understandable to people who are general humanities readers and not experts on film or music or whatever your topic is. So you'll never be able to second guess who the specialist and the discipline specialists are, but you can make a pretty good stab at the generalist reader, at who's going to read it on the College of Experts. You look on the ARC website, you check on out your college, which in this room will almost certainly be HCA, Humanities and Creative Arts. Look at who is on the panel. Cross out anybody who is at your own institution, even if you don't know who they are, if you've never met them, cross them out because they won't be they won't touch your application. Then cross out anyone you have worked for, anyone you have published with, anyone who is on a grant with you. They also won't have anything to do with your application. Then you can sort of think, well, who's left? If there is somebody from cultural studies, currently there is, if there is somebody whose discipline is sort of adjacent, that's probably who's going to get to read it first. And then the second person will be probably the next person in the closest discipline. It's not foolproof, but it's a pretty good bet. And even if it isn't, even if you don't necessarily get those people, I know from experience, I find it really useful to have the face of somebody in my mind as I'm writing my application. Okay, so when I worked out the last grant I've got, I looked at who was on the site, figured, okay, Bob, you're the one who's probably going to get it first. I knew basically what Bob wrote, and I had Bob in my mind the whole time I was writing my grant. I have no idea. I know Bob now. I have no idea if Bob read my grant. He wouldn't remember even if I asked him. He wouldn't tell me even if I asked him. But it didn't matter. It made me keep it focused. So pay attention to those sorts of things that you can actually help yourself with. Now, the second is the first handout. This is a pretty simple handout. It's just taken directly, cut and paste, from the guidelines for the ARC. But it's a selection of the guidelines that a lot of people don't pay very much attention to. This is how your application is going to be assessed, and it's not classified information. It's absolutely in the guidelines. But as I say, most people forget about it. It's important because of the emphasis you need to put on each of these categories. I should just add, this is discovery, it's not DP. Not DECRA. DECRA is slightly different, but whatever I'm saying about the discovery, or DP, applies to DECRA as well. You need to pay attention to how much the percentage is, what weighting the percentage is for each of these sections. So as I'll come to in a minute with significance and innovation, or project quality and innovation, that's 25% of your entire score. So if you do what some people do and just put two paragraphs for that, you're not helping yourself at all. You need to have 25% of your 10 pages as the significance and innovation. It's not a hard and fast rule, but that's giving you a sense of how significant, how major that section is. Okay? So, the importance of this page is the headings that the ARC is thinking about, but also those weightings. So I'll just go through some of these things in a little bit more detail. And the first one, the investigator. As it says on the handout, it's subject to ROPE, or research opportunity, and performance evidence. So it's not just people who are at the top of their field who will get who will be deemed to have a good track record. Other people will be too. If you can demonstrate that, is that mine? No, oh, it is mine. Sorry. if you can demonstrate that that with the opportunities you've had, you have made the most of them, and you've actually got a very good track record for someone at your stage of career. If you don't, the answer is not to make up stuff. Okay? If you even embellish your track record, there's such a good chance that someone else in the room, or someone else reading it, one of the assessors, will recognize that this can't be true. You just don't want that to happen. That could well defeat your chances altogether. If your track record isn't all that great, and if others tell you, well, the idea is fantastic, but your track record isn't really worth the 40%, consider collaborating with someone else. And several of us have said that we are collaborating with other people. That's one way to balance a slightly weak track record, especially if the person you're collaborating with has a stronger track record. There is a myth that you only get up if you are in a team in the Humanities and Creative Arts panel. It is a myth. I wouldn't know exactly what the results are, but...
Yeah, there were more individual ones last year than there were collective.
I didn't do the analysis.
I did. I counted them.
Okay. So a good sole project will still get up, and we've got several people in this room who are testament to that. Okay, if you are working on a team, try to make sure that what each person is bringing is complementary. You don't necessarily want to collaborate with someone who reproduces exactly what your own strengths are. You want to collaborate with someone whose experience is bringing in something else that is going to aid this wonderful project, this wonderful idea you've got. Keep in mind that everybody gets evaluated, so it's not just the first CI, it's all the team members. And it's really important to demonstrate that you have collaborated before. Haven't all got together as of the 1st of February in the year that the application is due. Now that doesn't mean you all have to be, all of you need to be joint authors on a paper. There are all sorts of other ways that you can collaborate, or maybe several people have collaborated and then several other people on the grant have collaborated and then there's a connection to separate teams. There are multiple ways to think about that, but it is important to demonstrate that you're not coming together. Okay, significance and innovation. I mentioned that you do want to take this part very seriously. Explain what is new about your project and why it's important, and why it's important now. What is so significant about it now? How is it advancing the field? How is the approach or the conceptualization innovative? And if it's relevant, how it connects to national benefits, national research priorities. All projects need to connect to national benefits, but we're encouraged to put in a national research priority, but they don't really map on to the research that most of us do very well. So don't force it. If it doesn't, just set it aside and don't apologize and don't try to force it. Okay, feasibility. Explain exactly what it is you're going to be doing. Research is not enough. You have to explain what the nature of the research is, how you're going to go about it. What is the timetable and the sequencing? How are you going to finish it in 3 years? That doesn't mean that if you're proposing to have a book, you need to have the book off to the publisher at the end of the 3 years, but you need to recognize that it's going to take more than 6 months to write a book. Need to have worked that through through the 3 years a little bit more carefully than just sticking it in the last 6 months. How is the method connected to the project aims? So the aims that you put into the first paragraph, roughly the first paragraph, need to come back through the 10 pages. They don't just get forgotten about after you've listed them. National benefits again. What are the national benefits of your research? Everybody has national benefits. Even if your work is, I'll make this up, looking at basket weaving in Central Africa, or throat singing in Tibet, that has to have some way of connecting to national benefits in and for Australia. And Maine, even with those topics, is not as difficult as you might think, especially connected to culture and to social good, social well-being, things like that. If you're going to be writing a book, I find that the feasibility section is the best place to put the table of contents and a bit of a description about the book, about what each chapter is going to look like. Fleshing out what it is you're going to do in your research, what the outcomes will be, whether a book or a series of articles, fleshing it out and saying what these are about is going to help you define your project, and it's also going to help your assessors, whoever they are, establish that you actually have worked through this topic very well already. It's not something that you designed over Christmas dinner. Okay. All right, budget. There's a myth out there that says whatever you want your budget to be, double it and put it in. That's also a myth. It seriously is a myth. If you do that, you're I can't say that you won't get the grant, but your budget will be curtailed severely. It's pretty easy for people who are reading these to work out when a budget is padded, and that tends not to go over very well. So be realistic in your budget. The budget will get scrutinized. There isn't a set percentage for it, but it does actually get accounted for. So it pays to be realistic. Trips for research travel that don't really seem necessary will get cut. You know, if the travel's not integral to the project, you don't really have to go to X, just don't put it in. It's a very rare person who needs a full-time 3-year research assistant, you know, an FTE of one. If you really do need that kind of a research assistant, and I can imagine that there are some projects, particularly in linguistics, where you might need somebody doing an awful lot of analysis, then make sure you justify it. But most of us don't need a full-time 3-year research assistant. So think carefully about what you need a research assistant to do. I'm certainly not saying don't put in for research assistants, just don't overdo it. Don't go overboard. Teaching relief. I've said this many times before. I don't know how many times, in countless applications you read, I need teaching relief because I have a heavy teaching load. Full stop, next section. And well, you know, there aren't too many people around in the humanities in Australia who don't have a heavy teaching load. That's not a justification. You need to actually justify why you need the teaching relief, that you need to go somewhere where you can only go during term time, that you need to do very detailed investigation that requires days on end of analysis, and that the summer's not long enough to do that kind of thing, or whatever it happens to be. You need to actually say why you need the teaching relief, what you need it, as well as what you need it for. The justification of the budget is also really important. So once you've worked out what your budget is going to be, explain how you got the costings, whether it's a Qantas or a Virgin or a whatever airfare, that it is the ATO, subsistence level for accommodation overseas, that it's an HEW 5.1 or whatever, for those of you from Griffith and QUT, whatever the scale is for the research assistants, and how many hours you need the research assistants for how many weeks. Put in as much of that detail as you possibly can. If nothing else, it makes it look as if you've actually done your homework and you know what you're talking about. You haven't just plucked $20,000 out of the air and thought that'll be a good amount for travel or for research assistants or whatever. You know what you're talking about. You factored this carefully. Okay, 100-word summary and keywords. Those are things that I never really got when I first started doing this, first started writing ARC grants. they're actually way more important than I realized. It's worth spending some time on working out what your keywords are, getting that summary right. It's not the last thing you write. You have to spend some time on it. And working out what your FOR codes are. The keywords and the FOR codes will determine who your assessors will be, the external assessors. So if you want a particular type of person to read, you know, particular person from a particular discipline to read your grant, make sure that discipline is in your FOR codes. Make sure that discipline is pointed to in your keywords. If there's a particular type of discipline you don't want to read your grant, which is quite legitimate if your work kind of crosses over into other areas, don't put that FOR code in. Don't put keywords that will point to that particular discipline. And it's a good idea it says six keywords, but you don't have to put six in. You know, if there are three that are perfect, don't search for others, because that could get you people you don't necessarily want to have reading your application. I always thought if there were six spaces, I had to put six in, but you don't. And avoid things like 999 codes. They tend to be a bit of a grab bag. Or other disciplines, that kind of thing. So be as specific as possible with your FORs. All right, just some pointers on what to do and what not to do. And again, while this is some common sense, I think it's always useful to hear it again. What to do? Present your research, your 10 pages, in an exciting way. If it's boring to read, it's not going to get up, okay? It's not really going to sound like the government needs to fund it. So make it sound like you are really excited and enthused by this. I think it's easier for people in our disciplines to do that because, well, we understand language a little bit better than some people. But, get someone to do a check for you. When you work on these for so long, sometimes you can't see it anymore. And if someone's saying, well, it sounds a bit flat, then put a little bit more zing into it. Okay. It's important to demonstrate that this work needs to be done now. So it's not work that should be done in 10 years' time or 20 years ago. It's work that needs to be done now. Explain why it needs to be done now. What's so vital about it now? Provide a context for your work. So this is not the time to suggest that you are the only person working on this topic and you really don't care what anyone else is doing on this. You want to be demonstrating that you understand where your research fits into the national and the international scheme of things. So if you can demonstrate that you are at the forefront of something that's international, that's going to look really good. Help your readers out with typographical assistance. Many of us read an awful lot of grants, and many of us work right to the deadline to get them done. So if you can help out with dot points rather than 10 pages of text that has no breaks or no headings or anything, we're going to like that a lot. Use bold, but don't overdo it. Use headings as well as the headings that the ARC asks you to use. You can use subheadings. Just try to keep whatever system you've set up consistent all the way through your 10 pages, so that we don't lose track of what you're trying to do. And yes, as I said, use the headings the ARC insists in the order that they provide them. And try to be as clear as you can about what it is you're trying to do and why that's important. Proofread carefully. People forget about proofreading as they try to get their application in by the deadline, but typos don't help. Typos really, really don't help. Okay, a couple of things about what not to do. Lots of jargon, lots of impenetrable language, lots of complicated prose. That's a real what not to do. Anything that makes the application hard to read. The simpler, the clearer, the better. Anything that suggests you really don't know what's going on in this field elsewhere, that's not going to help. Overstating your claim. either your claim about your research or your claim about your track record. That's also not going to go very well for you. If anybody could look at your grant and think, that's so last century, that's so old, you really need to rethink what you're doing. It's reasonable to look at something that is 10, 20 years old if you are rethinking the field and if you've got a really good reason for doing it now, for completely turning it on its head. But if anyone can think, oh, I think this is a bit dated, you need to be thinking again about whether this is the project to put in. And then the last are the other two handouts that I've got. If you look at this handout first, the one with the upside down triangle, the apex at the bottom, that's how we tend to write an article, a chapter, a book. We start at the general and eventually work down to our point. We lay things out really carefully for the reader, and by the end, they see everywhere you've come from and what the point is you're trying to sell. Even if you've put at the very top, the point of this paper is X, what I'm arguing is X. This tends to be how we argue. The other diagram with the apex of the triangle at the top is the one that is the way that we have to write an ARC grant. So each section of your grant ought to have a triangle like this. The first sentence ought to be the most important point. Okay? Then you draw out to the more general. And you might even find, if you write your sections like this, that it's easier to cut a lot of the stuff at the bottom because you've already gone over it, you've gone through it. It's no longer as relevant if you're working in this shape compared to this shape. Does that make sense to everybody?
It's like writing journalism.
Exactly. It's like writing journalism. So you put the most important things at the top. And as in journalism, they cut the bottom paragraphs or cut from the bottom.
Yep.
Okay, a couple of other things. As I mentioned at the very beginning, go to any session there is about ARC grants that's relevant to your discipline or basically social sciences and humanities. If you're at UQ, make sure you subscribe to the RNI information email. It's important not just for what I said at the very beginning about being told about new things that you never thought of before as you're writing your grant. The ARC keeps releasing new information. And so if you subscribe to the information that your research office provides, you'll find out what the latest is on the guidelines. Okay? It's actually really important to know how the guidelines have changed from last year. If you read last year's guidelines and not this year's, you could be setting yourself up for trouble. So make sure you read the guidelines as well. If you're at UQ, make sure you get your grant into RNI, the research office, on time, because they'll go through all the nitty-gritty detail to pick up things that we forget about. They also make sure that things are consistent, that what you've said in your justification of your budget is true in the budget page and things like that. Workshop your grant and your ideas and your application with whoever will listen, and keep trying. Now, I'm happy to answer questions about this or other general things. Great.
Jane, when you were talking about the sort of 10-page section at the moment, you said project quality innovation, that's 25%, as though, and sort of there was an intimation there that you'd have 25% of that section on that. But most of your investigator stuff is going to come in all of the other sections now, isn't it? So wouldn't the actual project description about the quality and innovation actually constitute much more than that?
Yeah, I'm using it as a metaphor. Sure, okay, 25% of 10 pages is 2.5 pages. That would be quite reasonable for the 10 pages, given the other sections that you have to do. Mm. Half a page is probably not reasonable.
Joanne, can I ask...
You're right about the maths. I'm in HCA.
Can I ask a very basic question about the levels of reading that things go through? So you mentioned now we have a specialist and a discipline specialist, but also the generalist reader who's on the College of Experts. So what is the weighting of each response or report on the project? Do they all get equal weighting in terms of final outcomes of project?
I can't answer that, Elizabeth, not because I'm being coy. That changes regularly.
Yeah, and I did wonder about that.
I don't. There are complex logarithms. Logarithms? Thank you, algorithms. I told you I wasn't good at math. complex algorithms that work out final scores that we don't see and we don't need to know, so we just don't pay attention to. There are between 1 and 8 readers for, ideally 6, for the specialist and discipline specialist that you'll get, and 2 of the ARC COE readers. Mm. So all of those people will read carefully and put a score, and all of that gets grouped by the ARC people.
Joanne, you mentioned about writing in research assistants. What about writing in postdocs?
Yeah, that's complicated. Mm. It's happened. Postdocs are often one of the first things to go in the budget when the money runs out or starts to run out. I think you can do it, but I think you have to have a really, really good justification for why it's needed. Again, that's not to say it's not possible. But if it looks like you're just putting the postdoc on to get you up to the minimum, well, your grant probably is not going to be successful. Yeah. And it might be the same with RHD students as well. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Does the amount of money you request have any bearing on your success?
No. But the amount of money you request against the project you are proposing does. So if you're requesting an outrageous amount of money, but you're doing something that where you can actually account for every single one of those dollars, the grant is deemed to be absolutely significant and innovative, chances are you will get a good proportion of that. But it's a rare, rare person who gets the whole budget. Really, really rare person, because there just isn't enough money to go around. And a lot of people whose grants are below the success rate are still writing fantastic applications. So difficult decisions have to get made. But can I just say there's a corollary to that too. There is a minimum you need to apply for in the discovery. You have to meet the minimum of, I've forgotten now what it is, if it's 30, 40, or 50,000 per year. Whatever the minimum is, you need to be there plus a little bit over, just a little bit over for each year. DECRA's easier because it's all pretty set. Sorry, Greg.
Could you actually give some specific examples? This is not a facetious question. Some specific examples of what you would say in response to national benefit of a project on basket weaving in Central Africa.
Okay, well, I guess it would depend on the project and whether there were comparisons to basket weaving in Australia. And after all, I'm not being facetious either. There's quite a tradition of basket weaving in Indigenous Australia, so there could easily be a connection there. But I think you could also talk about the nature of the development of culture and the development of analysis of material objects or things like that, and how that is going to help people in Australia understand both Central Africa and Australia and basket weaving. And
do you think it's mostly necessary or advisable then to really be thinking about the applications of research, or is it enough to be saying, you know, that this shows that Australia is a powerhouse in this particular area of intellectual activity?
I think that's good too. Okay. It may be several. There may be 5 or 6 features to the national benefit. But it's not going to be good enough to say it has national benefits, full stop. And
well, that kind of response maybe encourage a dot point response.
Yeah.
Articulating 5 or 6 different benefits to national culture, maybe international culture.
And there may be different outcomes for different national benefits for different outcomes. So, for instance, say you're running a symposium on this kind of basket weaving that's going to take place in Australia, but it's going to bring experts from Kenya or different parts of Central Africa to Australia, then you can do an awful lot more in Australia. The national benefits there are going to be different than the monograph that you might also do, or the 6 articles that you might also write. Does that help?
And now we see why Joanne is so successful.
But I didn't get my ARC this past year. And I'm trying again.
But on that, you can't actually apply for costs of a symposium, can you?
A workshop. You can.
A workshop. You can.
Sorry, yeah. I used the wrong word.
Well, I am also mindful of the time, both Joanne's and wanting to have time for everyone to ask specific questions about their project to Gay and Tom in this session. So I think we should thank Joanne. That was so helpful. I have written pages of notes, so thank you for that.
Good luck, everybody.
Thank you so much for coming in, Joanne. And so I think maybe Gay and Tom can talk directly after each other, and then we'll just open it up for questions after that. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'll probably say stuff that's very similar to what Joanne said, because there's a tried and true set of rules with these things. But we might try and pitch it more around cultural studies. Not that I've got any extra insight into that, except to say I've had three discoveries and a linkage in cultural studies. I just put in another linkage a couple of weeks ago, and I put in a discovery last January, and it was successful, and that was called The Skin of Commerce, the Role of Plastic Packaging in the Construction of Food Security, Waste and Consumer Activism in Australia. So I think I assess a lot. I've been done an enormous amount of assessing for the ARC, and I now assess for the just been doing some assessing for the Canadian Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council and the Netherlands. So, and I've done ESRC for the UK. So I've seen an enormous number of grants. I think the most important thing that strikes me about being an assessor, and that you learn when you then start when you write them, is that the actual research problem is absolutely central. That grant, for me, will be won or lost on the first page if I am not engaged with the problem or the issue, if it doesn't strike me as something that's interesting and important that needs to be researched, then I find that you're really battling after that. So capturing the sort of excitement and the significance of your research issue is a very, very important thing to do straight up. And the other thing that's interesting about that is that often I'll read very interesting applications that are a bit like articles, where I'll often think, well, do you really need money to research this? You know, what are you asking for here? What is the actual research component of this very interesting, very sophisticated theoretical set of questions or whatever? Why does it need research? So you're asking for a lot of money here, so you know you have to be able to establish that the money is necessary in order to pursue this question. Many questions I've seen do not really need a lot of money to answer them. They need you to be allowed to sit in a quiet room and read and think for quite a while. And you might be able to do that through study leave or whatever. So it's kind of easier for me because I have a cultural studies is a very interdisciplinary area, so I've got a training in sociology and philosophy, so I can... All my projects have had a very applied, hands-on, real world. You do actually need to go out and look at, in this project, it's looking at the history of the plastics industry in Australia. It's actually doing some serious research that has never been done that is about real things and developments, historical and institutional. It's about the rise of the supermarket. It's about tracking when consumer activism emerges. So, you know, there are some really on-the-ground, hands-on research activities that need to be done here. It's easy for me to justify what the question is and also why you then need research. The second thing I'll echo from Joanne's statement is that it needs to be original. If you're digging around in turf that many other people have dug around in, you think, well, we kind of know this. What is exciting and, you know, what's the new angle you're bringing to this? What are you adding here? So I'm not saying it has to be sort of never thought of before, but saying that you're going to do something in a field that's already fairly well trodden is not going to get you a discovery grant. It's called a discovery project. And it's very interesting. When I read the last assessor's comments, for this project, someone actually said, this is the essence of what the Discovery Project is about. And it was a really interesting comment. I've never thought about that, but they were saying, you know, that it's not a great big... they're saying what they liked about the project, it wasn't a great big thing, oh, climate change is going to be the end of the world. It was very specific, it was very targeted, it was very empirical, and it was about a real question and a really pressing, urgent thing, and we absolutely didn't know anything about it. So in that sense, the issues of originality are very, very important, I think. For me, they are anyway. The other thing that I think that's important is, if you work in any area of literary studies, grants are a genre. Okay, so read as many as you can. You have to get into the zone when you're writing a grant, and you've got to write in the ARC genre. And that's basically what Joanne was saying in terms of her two triangles. You have to write in that grant writing style. And similarly with the section on yourself as the investigator, which is worth 40% in a discovery, how much is it in a DECRA? I think it must be pretty significant.
It might be the same.
Yeah. Anyway, you have to write a narrative about yourself. It's like a job application. You have to rewrite your CV so that it looks like for your whole life you have just been moving towards this research grant. It sounds crazy, but I mean, I work in two completely different areas. I didn't even mention the other area I research in this grant. I just framed myself as, I don't think about anything else but plastic, and here I am ready to do another project, and everything I've written feeds into this. That's exactly how it got assessed. Right, so I directed how people should read my track record. I framed my track record in a particular way. The other thing you should do is you should say, like, why is your work significant? What contribution has it made to cultural studies? Why do you stand out from the pack? In what sense are you, you know, contributing to an important conversation in cultural studies? So that's very important, the way you frame and present your research background and history and expertise, because you've got complete control over that. That doesn't mean that that is all just fantasy and bullshit. It has to be always based in evidence. But the way you organise that evidence, the way in which you pitch your expertise and your interests, is a really important thing to do, because it's just going to shape how you are judged and how your capacity to do the research is assessed. And you've got complete control over shaping that. The other thing Joanne's mentioned is pick your FOR codes extremely carefully. That is the area where you are, again, controlling who's going to assess it. So I was, you know, extremely careful that I only wanted cultural studies people to assess this. Even though it could have been assessed by sociology, political theory up to a point, I absolutely did not want it to stray into those areas, because they would have found aspects of it too wild and outside of their discipline to handle it. It just would have got annihilated. So I absolutely wanted to pitch it and target it at the field where I am well known and where I knew that I would have some control over.
So was that 100%?
No, I think I had cultural studies at about 50%, and then cultural theory and consumption in everyday life.
Which are in cultural studies?
Yeah, the subsets of cultural studies.
So in other words, it was 100%
Yeah, 100%, 2002 codes, yeah. So targeting assessors is very... And I wasn't originally going to do that. I did have keywords, which are things like sociology, food, and then Graham Turner looked and said, get rid of all that. This will go everywhere. And that's such a high-risk strategy. The fewer and more contained assessors you have, the more likely you're going to get assessed in the terms in which you framed it. The other thing I'd say is, as Joanne has mentioned, she didn't mention research environment. It's 15% now, so it's pretty crucial that you actually frame...
It's higher in DECRA.
Yeah, even higher in DECRA. Yeah, so it's very important to get that right too, and to talk about where your research is going to be based. Tom will probably be able to say more about that. But that's not an insignificant section, because obviously, you know, they are looking to make sure that you are going to be located in the place where you have the capacity to do your research and where your research is going to value add to existing capacity. Partnerships. I started mine as a sole author project, mainly because it was left till very late, and I wasn't originally going to do it because I thought I was going to do a linkage. Then they cancelled linkages and I had to do a discovery in about 5 weeks, which was pretty tough. At about week 3.5, I thought, I think I might need a partner, because I'd heard that rumour that sole authored discoveries are hard. So I actually contacted someone who's published an essay of hers in an edited collection. I've never actually met her, but she's doing incredibly compatible research, and she did definitely value add, and that's what the assessor said, that this was a very compatible team. So if you're going to have a team, you need to show why the group works. Not that you're all doing the same stuff, but you're all covering and bringing different expertise to the project, which significantly enhances your capacity to do it. So it was a high-risk strategy on my part. She's an international partner, so that was fairly complicated in terms of the logistics of the budget and all that, but the research office here was extremely helpful. But she definitely is bringing something to this project that I do not have. And so together, it really... is much more powerful, the actual quality of the researchers. The other thing I'll say, and Joanne has mentioned this, it's just a basic rule in research grant writing. If you start off with a list of four key aims, as I do on page one always, and you've got to get to them pretty fast, then I would expect to see in the feasibility and research design a clear account of how each of those aims are going to be delivered on. That's just, I can remember when I heard that years ago at a research information seminar, I thought, God, that's interesting. I never thought of that. But obviously it's a basic rule that if you say you're going to do stuff, you have to show very clearly how. So, and that's the crucial way in which feasibility is measured. You've said you're going to have, you've got all these aims, show us how they will be delivered on. So there's a clear framework in mind where each aim is an explanation of how each aim is going to be done, what the time frame is, and how each aim feeds into the next. Very important. I think that's probably... Oh, in terms of, you asked about postdocs, I've asked for a research associate in this project, I asked for 3-year full-time research associate, which is how I got around the postdoc thing.
And so is that the same as an
assistant? Well, then they're called a research associate. That means they have to have a PhD, and basically they're going to be employed as a postdoc. Yeah. But you had to have a pretty solid justification that there was 3 years' worth of full-time work to do on this project. Yeah. Tom?
Okay, I've got a... Maybe I began with a... Begin with a story that I was told today. It's actually a historian told me this story. He'd put in an application for a grant 2 years in a row. The second year he got it up, and he said that one of the most significant conversations he had in developing the grant was the conversation he had with me. And the conversation entirely revolved around the distinction between what was the content and subject matter of his research and what was, if you like, the overall orientation within which that research sat. So his research was being conducted in the Pacific, which led him to propose that the research was Pacific. But really, the research was about the American extension of itself to the Pacific. So it was about American history as it related to the Pacific. So this sort of complicated distinction really mattered. Because if it was specific history, it would go to a bunch of readers that would not recognise the extension of American history, which is what he was doing. They would come from a different point of view. They'd come from the point of view of the Pacific and its history, as opposed to extensions of the American Empire into the Pacific, or the conduct of the Second World War as a part of the conduct of the World War in the Pacific, which is what his stuff was on. And I just think that's an important kind of difference, where the keywords kind of find ways to matter. So this meant that, you know, RFCD code was historical studies, right? So it's going to go to historians. But it was the difference between going to someone that was like an historian of Papua New Guinea, or an historian of New Zealand, or an historian of the Samoa, in which case you're likely to see some crossovers with anthropological expertise in there as well, or going to an American historian with a view of the expansion of empire and various projections of American power, and et cetera, et cetera. Now, his research was in that component. He's an American historian. So my contribution was simply pointing that out to him. You know, you are actually an American historian. This is actually American history. This is an extension of American history. It is Pacific history, but it's not centrally Pacific history. And so you will be doing yourself down if you put that, because you will not be clear whether you will get the right reader. Now, this makes it seem that readers can be right and wrong, which is, I stand by that. There can be right readers and there can be wrong readers. And this makes it seem as if it's very arbitrary, as if you're trying to pre-select it. But when you think about this a bit further, you'll kind of see that it's actually about choosing what is the most appropriate people to assess your application. So it's not like you're stacking the books in your favour, you're just choosing the most appropriate people to assess your application. And I think that's a really critical kind of point, you know, and that's where the keywords are important, that's where the RFCD codes are important. Now, what we have in cultural studies is a situation in which there are roughly, depending on who you're speaking to, I mean, Gay would probably add another code into this, but I'm just going to say that by and large, you've got cultural studies, you've got communication and media studies, two different RFCD codes, you've got film, television and digital media, that's already three. And then, if you're more sociologically inclined, like my colleague, you've potentially got sociology. So you've actually got a problem at times of choosing among those. The last year when I did this same grant, I kind of chose, I think, retrospectively, my RFCD codes wrongly. I kind of emphasised, because it was around television and television studies, and that was in film, TV and digital media, that it was more there. And I got readers who were kind of basically telling me that I didn't understand the formation and organisation of the film and television industries, even though from the point of view of other fields, they might say that I was knowledgeable in this area. So when I did it again this year, I left out 1902 altogether and simply put communication and media with a subsection in cultural studies. So it's sort of like, now there were certainly people in 1902, people like my colleague Jason Jacobs, who I would have liked that grant to go to, but isn't my institution, you can't get it. But there were also in that code going to be people who were very much into various kinds of experimental film production, sort of iCinema kind of viewpoints, and they had a view about what innovation looked like and various other things looked like that meant that this was not legible to them. So it was the wrong grant in the wrong territory. I felt very miffed when I got my initial assessments. And I channeled it entirely incorrectly. Because, you know, initially I just thought, how dare they say I don't know and have had no connections with the industry when I can point to my connections with and, you know, strong relations with a whole variety of film and television agencies, from both producers right through to agencies and executives of corporations, etc., etc., etc. But it was misplaced, because what I'd failed to consider was the ways in which those code, you know, the ways in which people were doing the best they could with the resources and the knowledge base that they had available to them. And within that context, certain things were going to be centred as opposed to other things. And that becomes kind of an important component of the picture. The other thing I wanted to kind of say something about was about the kind of research environment. Research environments are really hard to write, and they are the place where you kind of see the most bragging. Now, problem with bragging about, you know, whether you've got a 4, a 3, a 5 in ERA, for example, or whether you've got kind of you know, big figures in the field, right? All that kind of stuff is that. Think about how that's going to go down with a reader. You know, who are going to say, well, you know, the last good book O'Regan wrote was Australian National Cinema in 1996. This other stuff he's written on studios and stuff is just super rubbish. Now, but you know what I mean? I mean, it's just taking this a bit seriously. So really what you've got to do there is see the research environment as a way of making your argument about the nature of your project. So don't see it as a bunch of assets, you know, like your lint chocolates in your drawer. See it as part of your the way of making and framing your argument. So, in the case of my grant application, I foreground, in order, because part of what I was doing was also taking up aspects of the organisation in space of studios, television stations, production companies, etc. That was a mechanism for me to bring in the fact that you know, one of my colleagues here is Peter Spirit, one of the most prominent urban historians, who's actually written quite a bit, fortuitously, about both the nature and organisation of Australian urban space, but critically on popular culture as well. So it was like that became a way of making that case. The fact that Jason is researching the BBC International and contemporary practices in the television drama production industry internationally constitutes a point of reference for how Australian practices connect with and are distinct from these. So, you know, you're not saying that here are these assets that are floating around and you know, we're so good. You're saying these particular sets of people constitute an horizon within which this research can be effectively accomplished. So it's and often your institution is broader than that, and also, why not make an argument about your town? You know? In my grant application, I wasn't shy about mentioning the fact that I'd written stuff with colleagues at both QUT and Griffith, and that these had been long-standing relationships, and that the research was partly built on that long-standing connection. So,
Tom, is it okay to just sort of ask at this point, what do you think this means, the emphasis, which is quite new for those of you who don't know, on research environment? That was a category that didn't exist a few years ago.
It's always been there.
But what do you think about people who are applying from regional locations where we can't, you know, where people won't be able to make the same arguments that, you know, you could make at university?
Well, but you know, I mean, what is a research environment? A research environment might... You'd be surprised at what assets your particular institution have. You know, I mean, you just get surprised at what you've got. You know, the people in this room, I know that got other people, but it gets QUT and Griffith, really quite an impressive array of people you've got there. You can easily kind of think about. The problem is that you tend to think of your horizon line in terms of just your unit that you're in, whereas that horizon line might be broader. The people that are interested in the kind of things that you're interested in might be broader. If you're in, you know, kind of a sort of a computer IT kind of related sort of application, it might be that there are some people in education that have actually got some very interesting things to say around various kinds of educational technology and various other things of that kind. So it's thinking, it's being able to think in and pitch it in those kinds of terms. I mean, one of the things that my institution here made a terrible mistake at when the DECRAs first came out, they decided that they'd have a sort of a paragraph that had to be stuck in. And, you know, when I was the Associate Dean Research for the Faculty of Arts, I tried to take out that paragraph and minimise it and reshape it and read it, but they kept putting it back in because of an institutional statement. And I just knew it was a waste of space because it wasn't tailored to the application. It was a generalised statement that could only say to people who weren't at the University of Queensland that here was the University of Queensland application saying we're so good, get stuffed. You know, and that's no way to treat an assessor. Because it was too general. It wasn't specific enough. It's got to be specific to the project. And that's where some of the regional kind of thing comes in. Because at times you actually have a variety of research that may be very specific to the project. You know, it's this project. It's not the general question of communication and media studies at this university or cultural studies at this university. In Gay's case, it's about bloody plastic.
Well, everyone's interested in that.
Yeah, you know. But no, that's a cue.
Yes, but I think you can... Well, I'd like to hear what you're all doing with your research environment statements, because I think you can err on the side of just saying, oh, there's so-and-so here and there's so-and-so there. You can spread it so wide that it doesn't really look like a research environment. You have to set up an argument about the context of where the research is going to be done. Now, you can do the big UQ branding statement.
Which doesn't work. No, that's what I was trying to say. Don't go too large.
But you don't want to go in the opposite direction, which is sort of say, oh, there's lots of people I know who are interested in this. You have to say this research is part of an organisation that is, you know, it's adding to the capacity of that. The existing people who are going to be surrounding the project are going to feed into it as well. You have to prove that there's an environment that's going to be supportive for research and that the research is going to value add to that environment as well.
Which is my point about the argument.
Yes, you've got
it
to develop
an argument.
It should be part of your argument. Yes, not a generic statement.
Maybe if I provide an example, because I've actually thought about this question.
Yes, right.
Because I come from a media communications background, but I'm currently working in an engineering context. And the reason that I became interested in resonance was because I was in engineering and it actually resonated with electronic communications.
Yeah.
So I brought the two together. And the argument that I would put is because being located in an engineering intellectual milieu would provide the kind of ballast of argument from a physical sciences point of view to see how they might interact with that cultural analysis of resonance, which seemed to me to be very closely related from a physical and a cultural perspective.
Yeah, well, I think that sounds very interesting, but I would then be looking for, in your project description, a strong argument as to cross-disciplinary research.
That
you are opening up a conversation here between engineering, which hasn't thought very much about the cultural significance of resonance as both a sort of technical biophysical quality, that has these cultural reverberations, and you want to open up that, deepen.
That was the idea of the project, was to try and connect those two.
Yes, exactly. I think that sounds very, very interesting.
That's what I'm talking about, Tawanya.
Yeah.
I can get a sense that you're talking about not simply the identities involved. Mm.
But the intellectual connections.
It's intellectual.
Yes,
so it becomes
absolutely.
Part of your argument. If it's, that's a good expression, intellectual connection.
Yeah.
What are the intellectual connections? Because that will then foreground argument.
Yes.
And how it's helping develop what it is that you're doing.
Mm.
But how are other people approaching? Let's not throw this open. We need to hear more from you guys.
Yes, so shall we move into the question?
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's have a conversation. Sam, go for it.
Okay, thank you, Gaintar.
The project that I have in mind is an Australia-wide study that will have a number of location-based sort of case studies within it. So in that case, I've got people from a number of different institutions involved.